ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 हरि
Do we have a clock or a?
I can get a
clock and just put it here. So welcome to the first of three sessions on the Kathopanishad. This session and the one in the afternoon, in the evening today, and the one in the morning tomorrow. So do try to attend all three if possible. It's a package deal. The core of Vedanta are the Upanishads. They form part of the most ancient living religion of humanity, the Vedic religion, and the Upanishads form part of the Vedas. The highest philosophical teachings of the Vedas are found in the Upanishads. Among all the Upanishads, and there are many, 108 definitely, and there are many more, but among all of these, 10 Upanishads are of particular importance, probably because some 1400 years ago, Adi Shankaracharya, the great philosopher, non-dualist philosopher, he selected 10 of these to write commentaries on, Bhashyam. And these 10 Upanishads, with Adi Shankaracharya's commentary, they form the basis of Vedanta. It is in fact from these Upanishads that Sri Krishna taught Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, the message of the Gita is the same as the message of the Upanishads. Maybe in a more practical way, Sri Krishna selected... let me put the clock here.
11:04.
In fact, in some of the verses in the Bhagavad Gita, you find verses taken almost verbatim from the Kathopanishad. One Swami was saying that Sri Krishna, without any attribution, without any kind of reference, you know, coolly plagiarized everything, violating all copyright. And he quoted them so casually in the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita is also one of the core texts, part of the Vedantic canon, the core literature of Advaita Vedanta, of Vedanta. And the philosophical issues arising from the Upanishads are discussed threadbare in another text called the Brahma Sutra. Those are cryptic in the sutra form, aphoristic form, 555 sutras, which discusses all the questions that we may have when we listen to the Upanishads. Upanishads are inspired, poetic. Bhagavad Gita is more like a sermon, like a practical teaching, how to apply it in life. And Brahma Sutras are philosophical. So the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutras, together they are known as the Prasthanatrayam, the threefold foundational texts of Vedanta. Upanishads, Bhagavad Gita, and Brahma Sutras. Now, the 10 Upanishads, there's a nice little verse in Uttarakhand where they study it, so they have the 10 Upanishads in a verse. Isha kena kata prashna. You know it, munda mandukya titirihi. Aitareyam cha chandogyam brihadaranyakam tatha. Just a way of memorizing the names of the Upanishads. So, Ishopanishad, Kena Upanishad, Kathopanishad, Prashnopanishad is there. And then Aitareya, Taittiriya Upanishad, Chandogya, Brihadaranyaka, Mundaka, Mandukya. Among all of them, Maybe the most popular might be the one which we are going to take up today. It's also very simple, it's also very interesting and comprehensive. Kathopanishad. It was certainly Swami Vivekananda's favorite. He would quote often from it, especially when he came to this country and he gave talks in the late 19th century, last decade of the 19th century. He would often quote from the Kathopanishad, and he would praise in high, he would give high praise to its sense of poetry, the philosophy, the ethics. So the Kathopanishad, he would recommend it to his disciples to memorize it, the Kathopanishad. Even now in Swami Vivekananda's birthday, every year in Belur Math, in the room where he lived, because he liked classical music so much, so early in the morning, noted classical musicians, they come and sing there. And one of the things that's done there is beautiful chanting of the Kathopanishad. That's also done every year. So what I'll do is, I have selected some verses from the Kathopanishad, and we will take it in three stages. In the first talk today, we shall learn about the foundational teachings of Kathopanishad, how we prepare for spiritual life. And perhaps this is the most important of the three talks. Because this, if we get it right, at least to some extent, the rest is not so difficult. The second will be, after the preparation, initial preparation, investigating the self. How do I realize the self? Which Vedanta promises me that I am this immortal self, existence, consciousness, bliss. How do I realize that? A process will be taken up. Process of investigating, who am I? And the third talk will be on the self itself. What is the nature of that ultimate reality? That will be maybe the most abstract of the three talks. That will be tomorrow. So many of the Upanishads, they are based on a story. See, they are often in the form of dialogues between guru and shishya, the spiritual master and the student. Something in the form of a dialogue is very easy to learn because it's in the form of questions and answers, discussions. So we also find often the questions we have in our minds are being asked by the student, and the teacher gives answers to that. One of the most popular books of Swami Vivekananda is the Talks with Swami Vivekananda. His disciple Sharat Chandra asks so many good questions, and he took care to note down what Swami Vivekananda said in his diary. So that's part of the complete works of Swami Vivekananda, and many people love that. And next to that letter, so there's a living touch of a spiritual master. When a book, a lecture is a little more impersonal, but when you're writing a letter, that's more personal. And when you're actually talking with someone, someone puts questions to you and you give answers, that's most personal. So the Upanishads are in that form of question and answer. And Kathopanishad also is like that. And that is made more interesting with a story. So often there's a little story added to the Upanishad. This story is a story of a little boy, Nachiketa, who Shankaracharya estimates was in his pre-teens. So maybe 10 or 11 years old or something like that. And it's ancient India, the Vedic India. This was before the era of temples and pujas. At that time, religion meant big sacrifices, fire sacrifices, where the priests would light a fire and put offerings into it, chanting hymns to the Vedic gods. That was the original form of Vedic Hinduism. And such a fire sacrifice is the scene where this begins. The hero of our story is a little boy called Nachiketa. So he's a well-known character in Hinduism, one of the most ancient. I would say maybe he was the first Vedanta student. We are all Vedanta students now. So we are all in the lineage of Nachiketa. Yeah. He is the first batch alumni of the... So he, representing all of us, he asks these questions, which you find in all the Upanishads and in the Gita, and after that, down till today. Even something that Sharat Chandra asks Swami Vivekananda, similar questions. And the teacher is none other than the god of death. God of death, Yama. A really terrifying teacher. So, but we are getting ahead of ourselves now. The fire sacrifice is going on, and Nachiketa is there, and his father is conducting this fire sacrifice. There are different kinds of sacrifices. One of these sacrifices was that you perform a big ritual and you give away everything. Everything means everything. Whatever you own, you give everything away and you start afresh. Why would anybody do that? What was the purpose of these fire sacrifices? The idea in ancient India was not very different from what we have got today. Conventional religion means having a good life here and a good life hereafter. So good life here would mean you'd be healthy, you'd be prosperous, you'd have good relationships, you'd be happy here. Have a good family life. And hereafter would mean heaven. And the Indians don't have just one heaven. They have many, many heavens. So there are superior and inferior grades of heavens. And depending on how much merit we have got in the bank, in the cosmic bank, how much good we have done, how much merit we have earned, you get to go to the higher heavens. You can go to Malibu or you can go to Hawaii, you can go further and further, you know, better and better places, or Fiji or something like that. So there are higher heavens. That was the idea of religion, and it is more or less so. We have progressed in knowledge and in technology, but not much more in wisdom. Even till today, all over the world, whether you go to a Hindu temple or to a Christian church here, most of the times you will find what is being promised there is a good life. Happiness now. A good, nice life here. Real spirituality comes after that. It is a search for truth. In Hinduism, the idea is you can go to these heavens, but they are all impermanent. The heavens are something like an endless party. You are partying all the time. But as you know, chasing too much pleasure, after some time, nothing is pleasing anymore. Somerset Maugham writes that. If you chase pleasure single-mindedly, very soon you find nothing pleasing anymore. After that, a question comes to the human soul. Is this all that there is? All success we get in life, a beautiful life here, and maybe the promise of heaven afterwards, that's also kind of extended good life. But what is the meaning of all of this? What is the truth behind this game? This goes round and round. Once your merit is finished, once you have exhausted all the merit you have earned by these sacrifices, you come back from heaven and back here again. And if you want to go to that heaven again you have to earn a lot of merit by this sacrifice or that sacrifice or something. So Vedanta starts with a search for wisdom beyond this heaven concept. Good life here, happy life in heaven, but beyond that is what is there? What is the reality of this universe? Who am I? Is there any permanent peace and happiness to be had? So that search is spirituality. The search for God, the search for the truth about oneself, the search for the truth about this universe which we are experiencing, whether it's here or in heaven, whatever. So, that will come in the Upanishads. Before that is the realm of the fire sacrifices, Karma Kanda. Upanishads are what are called Jnana Kanda, the realm of knowledge, the portion dealing with knowledge. So here you find the transition. Nachiketa's father is performing a big sacrifice by which he hopes to go to some high heaven. And Nachiketa watches the rituals being performed and all the guests have come. You have to feed the guests and you have to give away all your possessions to the guests. Everything. But Nachiketa finds something strange. He finds his dad is giving away lots of things, and in those days wealth meant cattle. Wealth meant cattle. And that's not so strange. In this country, just about 100 years ago, wealth meant cattle, about 150 years ago.
Even in Iowa, this is this.
Yes, so farmland and cattle, so that's wealth. You have the whole culture of cowboys and all. So in Vedic times also, wealth, and too, for a long time in India, wealth meant cattle. Now, Nachiketa saw what his dad was doing was, he had kept all the good cows hidden away. And the cows which had become old, which are not giving milk, which would not give calves, and all those he was donating. And the guests probably knew what he was doing, but what could they do? They were polite and they had to take it away. And Nachiketa saw that his father, dad was cheating. He was just giving away the stuff he didn't need. And he says to his dad, whom will you give me to? I'm your son, so you're going to give everything away, right? So whom will you give me to? And at first his dad doesn't respond. And then he's being asked three times, then his dad gets annoyed. And he says, Mrityave tva dadamiti, I give you to death. It's more or less here you say, go to hell. Something like that. I give you to death. And Nachiketa says some very interesting, hard-hitting truths to his dad before he goes away to the land of death. Because his dad has sent him to death, so he goes away to the land of death. He says, okay, I'll go to death. But before that he says, the importance of being honest. He says, what is the use of all these rituals unless one means it? Whether they're true or not comes later. But you say you believe it and you are doing it and you want some results and yet you're doing it half-heartedly. You really don't mean it. And then he says, look at life. He gives us a short sermon on the transience of life. He says, almost in biblical terms, you know, in the Bible you find, look upon the corn of the field, they are here today and not they are not here tomorrow. In the same way, Nachiketa says, look upon this corn. I think it was Sashyam. Look upon this. All these fields, these plants, they come, they are here today and tomorrow they are cut down. Our lives, are they any more than this? So when life is so temporary and fleeting, what is the point of trying to save this little bit for myself and give away the other? This kind of dishonesty. Look at the way our ancestors have lived their lives. Should we not come up to that standard at least? And then he decides to go off to the land of death. Because his dad has told him to go to death. And you know, it's the Upanishads, it's poetry. So the little boy goes to the land of death. And then death is out. He's a busy man. He's a busy god. Because so many people dying all over, and it requires his personal attention. So he's on tour. And I think his assistants tell Nachiketa, you have to wait. He's not at home. So Nachiketa says, I'll wait. Would you like to have something, tea or coffee or something like that? I'm not making it up entirely. I'm making a little bit. It's not tea or coffee, but he did not eat. They asked him, would you like to have something to eat? He says, no. I'll wait until death comes back. I have to talk to him. 3 days and three nights, the little boy waited at the door of death without eating. Now, when death comes back, his assistants, maybe they say, he must be looking to catch up for all the work, paperwork that is piled up. Well, what's there on the table? He said, oh, this and that. And there's this little boy waiting for you, a very obstinate little kid. He's come here and he wants to talk to you, it seems. You can see the assistants of death sort of rolling their eyes. Death's, and he said, the little boy is so obstinate, he didn't eat. He's sitting there for 3 days. So death rushes out and, you know, greets the little boy and he says that, oh, little child, you've been waiting here 3 days and three nights waiting for me. It's a great sin if a guest comes to the house and you do not feed the guest. So I'll give you three boons. Whoever you are, I'll give you three boons. Nachiketa introduces himself and he's very happy. He's got three boons. You can ask for any three things. So the first thing that Nachiketa asks, now you can see the story is so touching, you know. Mm-hmm. He's a little kid. So what he's really worried about is his dad being mad at him. So the first thing he asks death is, when I go back home, let my dad not be mad at me. Let him be pleased with me. Now see how clever he is. Shankaracharya points it out. Nobody comes back from the land of death. So he could have asked that, you know. The first boon is, okay, let me be alive again. Let me go back to my life as a kid in my dad's home. He didn't ask that. He said, when I go back, taken for granted. There's this man to whom God appeared and after a lot of austerities and said, what do you want? And he said, let me eat with my grandson on golden plates. Now he's already asked for three boons in one boon. That he'll have a long life because he's going to see his grandson. And he's going to have a child and grandchildren. That's the second boon. And third is they're going to be so rich, they're going to eat on gold plates. So wealth and children and long life, he's got all, asked for all of it in one sentence. So Nachiketa is as clever as that. He asks for that, when I go back, let my father recognize me, let him be pleased with me, let him not be mad with me anymore. And you can imagine Yama, the fierce god of death, maybe a faint little smile, maybe he smiled a little. And he said, all right, your father will be very happy to see you when you go back. Good, that's done. Important thing, out of the way. The second thing he asks for is, what's the best fire sacrifice? Because I see all the grown-up people, you know, it's like today people are going to temples or churches and all. And so in those days, all the grown-up people were performing these sacrifices. So what's the best sacrifice by which I can go to the like the highest heaven? Best whatever, kids today would say. And Yama teaches him a particular fire sacrifice. And Yama is so happy with him. He says, from now on, this fire sacrifice will be called Nachiketa Agni. Will be named after you. And he teaches him that. So Nachiketa gets that also out of the way. Conventional religion. Best that can be had in life. Then he comes to the real question, the third question. And Yama says, ask, what more do you want? I don't want anything, but there's one thing I want to know. There's a question about life and death, about the self. What is the truth? Today, kids would say in America, give me like give me the truth. You know, I want to know what really exists. I remember in Ramakrishna Mission Deoghar, where I was a brahmachari, the little boy staged a play once on Nachiketa and Yama. This is a well-known play in India. Sometimes school children stage it. So Yama and Nachiketa. And the monks there helped the children to set up the play. So they set it up, but they didn't rehearse too well. And I remember Swami Atmasthanandaji Maharaj, who is now the president, he's very ill now, but he was at that time the general secretary of the order. He was visiting. So it was set up in his honor. And there were teachers and there were the students, guardians, the parents who had come to see the play, about an audience of 500 or 600 people. And the kids set it up, but it was a disaster. They forgot their lines and of course the audience enjoyed it thoroughly, but the kids were sweating. They were like, somehow let it end, let it come to an end. And there was a Swami who had helped them to set it up, and he had said the most important verses. It was, the play was in Hindi, but the most important verses, when it will come, I will chant it in Sanskrit. At that time the actors, the kids should just stay there on the stage. From the background, I'll play the harmonium and chant it in Sanskrit. And when the time came for the first important verse, the kids are standing there, and we were in the backstage and looking around, where's that Swami? Not to be found at that time. He's gone to take a washroom break at that time. And the kids are standing there waiting for the Sanskrit chanting to come. They're looking like this, and the audience is in splits. You know, they're clapping and hooting. So it was a disaster. So time came for the third boon to be asked. And the kid who was playing Yama, rather fat kid, well-built and hefty kid, looking especially fierce, he says, well, Nachiketa, ask for the third boon. And somebody in the audience shouted that, tell him I don't want anything, at least this thing will come to an end. This play will come to an end. We'll be saved of the further torture. So Nachiketa asks this question, this beautiful question. The fundamental spiritual question, really.
Yeyam prete vichikitsa manushe astitye ke nayam astiti chayke etad vidya manushishtas tvayaham varanamesha varastritiya.
This is 1.120, if you have got the book. You don't have to follow in the book, but I'll just tell you, some of you have got the books, I'll just mention which verse I'm referring to, which mantra I'm referring to. 1.1.20. This is where the Upanishad really starts, with a question. What's the meaning of this question? Nachiketa says to Yama, I have a question. I don't want anything anymore, but I have a question. I have a doubt, and everybody has this doubt. After death, some people say that we exist. Some people say we don't exist. And I would like to know the truth about the self, nature of the self. This is my third boon. Now we have to be careful what he is asking. Remember, he was part of the Vedic culture where it was accepted that after death you do exist in some form because you go to heaven. After all, you are performing all these sacrifices for going to heaven. So religion, every religion accepts that there is some existence after death, post-mortem existence. If everything is finished at death, there is no need of religion. That becomes just materialism. So all forms of religion, every religion in the world, will say that we have something after death that is there. So Nachiketa also knew this and he believed it. But what he was asking is not this ritualistic kind of thing, you know, where you perform some rituals and then you go to heaven and you come back again. That's all right. But what is the reality about the self? Who am I? I'm in this body, Nachiketa, and then this body will die, I'll go to heaven, I'll come back again, whatever. But who is this reality? What is the nature of the self? That is the question he's asking. And that is the subject matter of the Upanishads. The very word Upanishad, this Kathopanishad is also important because Shankaracharya, in his beautiful commentary on Kathopanishad, he begins with an explanation of the word Upanishad. Here you find the detailed explanation of the word Upanishad. I will not go into that, but basically the word Upanishad means Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman, spiritual knowledge, in to put it simply, knowledge about the ultimate reality. That is the meaning of the word Upanishad. And Shankaracharya says the book Upanishad is a secondary meaning. We say we are reading Kathopanishad. When we say we are reading Kathopanishad, have you got a copy of the Kathopanishad? Then you're talking about a book. You're not talking about spirit knowledge. You're not talking about having a copy of the knowledge. You're talking about the book. So the book is, in secondary sense, it's called an Upanishad. The real sense of the word Upanishad is Brahma Vidya. In the introduction, you can see Shankaracharya's commentary, how he derives the meaning Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman, from the word Upanishad. And this is the question he asks Yama. And then follows a long period, I mean several verse, mantras, where Yama tempts Nachiketa. The moment Nachiketa asks this question, Yama sort of is startled. This little kid asking such a question, you don't need to know this. You don't need to know. You don't need to know this. Nachiketa says, that's my only question. Look, boy, I've got so many other things to offer you. You have no idea. You're a kid. There's so many enjoyments. You want to live long. You want to have children and grandchildren. You want to rule over a kingdom. All of that is in my power. You say, just say the word, you'll get it. But don't ask this question. You want something beyond all this? People, your dad is performing these sacrifices to go to heaven. All the things which he hopes to get, which he believes he will get in heaven, I can give it to you in this life itself. Nahidrisha lambhaniya manushyai. Yama says to Nachiketa, human beings, mortal man, cannot think of such enjoyment. They'll die if they even think of such enjoyment. It's so much beyond their ability to think of. All those enjoyments I'll give to you. He says, Prathayasva. Sequential, you make a list. Like a Christmas, you the things which I want. Make a list of whatever you want. Here's perpetual Christmas for you. There's no limit to what you can ask for. So ask for these and don't ask me the question. He wants to see what Nachiketa's reaction is. Most people, we would say that, okay, I'll want both. I want all those things and the question also. And if you're forced to it, many of us would back out. You know, if you're forced to it, given a choice, this or the question, make up your mind. So, okay, I'll ask the question later. And maybe there are books, I can always read it up. But I can't get these things anywhere else. I can always go to and attend a Vedanta class and find out these things. But all the nice things, goodies he's offering, let me get that. I won't get that in life. Nachiketa is not fooled. He says, whatever you are offering me, at the end of it all, you are there. Death. I will die. You are not saying that I'll become immortal. I will die. Whatever you offer me, it comes to an end. And when it comes to an end, it's as good as it was never there. At that moment, when it's all gone, money is gone, relatives, wife and children and husband, and they're all gone, grandchildren are all gone. When the job is gone, health is gone, name and fame, people have forgotten me, I'm an old and dead and dying. At that moment, it's as good as if all of that never happened. Just memories for me. People have forgotten about it. That's it. So it's no good offering me all these things. You are there. And then he also says, Sarvendriyani Jarayanti Teja. All these things which you offer me, food, drink, and be merry, our capacity to enjoy is limited. Our capacity to enjoy is limited. You know, I love books. So I've been accumulating books. When I came to the United States, I thought I would have to give up all my books. But luckily some books were being transported from India to USA by ship to our center in Los Angeles. So a few more crates was no problem for them. So I could send them over free by ship. So I decided to select the books I wanted to keep and send them over. When I was selecting them, I found to my horror so many books which I had not read. Years ago I purchased them. I know it's there, I've not read it, but I hope to read it in future. So it's there. And I was reading Karma Yoga by Swami Vivekananda at that time. And I saw at that very moment, Swami Vivekananda is saying, a fool may accumulate all the books in the world. He will read only those he deserves to read. So I decided I'll stop buying books and start reading the ones I've got right now, which I've transported with great difficulty. But not just books, anything. How much can you eat? How many varieties of ice cream can you eat? How many types of cars can you ride on? How many places of vacation can you go to? It's enormous choice, especially in this country. The United States of the 20th and 21st century, you have more choice than was available to humanity earlier. In earlier times, maybe a few kings and queens had choice. Most people did not have much choice. But what you will consume now, where you will stay, what you will wear, where you will go and visit, how you will live, what job you will do, such tremendous choices there today, right now today. How you will entertain yourself, tremendous choices there. So this variety. But how much can you consume? How much can you consume? Very little of it. Because we don't have that capacity to consume. So, Nachiketa says, Sarvendriyani Jarayanti Teja. All the sensory systems decay and deteriorate and are overloaded very fast when you try to enjoy life. It's no good. I want that. And he's cheeky. He's a little kid, so he's a little cheeky to Yama. And he says, Tavaiva Vaha Atravanitya Gite. Yama had promised, I'll give you heavenly chariots and singing and dancing and musical instruments and things like that. And Nachiketa says, Tavaiva Vaha Atravanitya Gite. Keep your chariots and dancing and singing to yourself. You go and sing and dance. I want an answer to this question. He uses that language because he's a kid. And Yama is so pleased. He's not annoyed. He says, I wish I had more students like you. So you would be so Yama would be so happy to see so many students like Nachiketa here, you know, who have given up a nice weekend. You could have relaxed and watched TV at home. And you come to attend a Vedanta class. So that's what Yama wants. That you want to, you give up the transient pleasures of life and seek wisdom. So Nachiketa does that and Yama is very happy and says, I wish I had more students like you. And then Yama starts the teaching. I'll go back and forth a little bit. I'll tell you where I am selecting, about what I'm reading. Yama's teaching starts from the second canto, but what I am reading now is 1.3.4. 1.3.4.
Atmanam ratinam vidhi shariram ratham evatu buddhim tu sarathim vidhi manah pragraham evacha indriyani hayan ahur Vishayangsteshu gocharan Atmindriya mano yuktam bhoktetyahur manishinah.
I'll translate and then we will all read it together. This is the takeaway from today's lecture. That's why I want you to repeat it. What it means is, Yama says to Nachiketa, he gives him a model, a structure, a conceptual structure to think about himself. Think about yourself as the passenger in a chariot. The body is the chariot. The horses are the sense organs. The horses which pull the chariot, there are five horses. Five sense organs. And the paths their horses are running, it's a very strange kind of car which runs on five lanes at the same time. Don't do it, you'll get a ticket here. But this car, it runs on five lanes. Eyes run on the path of forms, they see. Ears hear. Tongue tastes. Nose smells. And skin touches. The five sense organs run on five sense objects. And the mind is the reins with which the charioteer holds the horses. The mind is connected to these horses, the five sense organs. And the intellect is the driver, buddhi. Intellect is the driver who holds the steering wheel. The mind is like the steering wheel of the car. And the wheels of the car are like the sense organs. And the driver is the intellect. And who are you? Normally we think that's what we are. He says, you are none of this. You are not the body, you are not the sense organs, you are not the mind, you are not even the intellect. The mind which thinks I am now listening to a talk by Swami, the intellect which is trying to understand the Upanishad, you are none of them. You are quite apart from them. You are quite apart from the body too. You are the passenger in the body, in the chariot. Atmanam ratinam viddhi. Know yourself to be the passenger sitting in the back. You're rich, you have a chauffeur, the intellect, who's driving the car of your body through the path of life. You are that person there. And this model is what he teaches Nachiketa. So let's repeat this verse and then this mantra and we'll go into it. Atmanam ratinam vidhi. Atmanam ratinam vidhi. Shariram ratamevatu. Shariram ratamevatu. Buddhim tu saratim vidhi. Buddhim tu sarathim vidhi. Mana pragraham evacha. Mana pragraham evacha. Indriyani hayan ahu. Indriyani hayan ahu. Vishayangsteshu gocharan. Vishayangsteshu gocharan. Atmindriya mano yuktam. Atmindriya mano yuktam. Bhoktetyahur manishinah. Bhoktetyahur manishinah. What does it mean? Atmanam, yourself. Ratinam viddhi. Know yourself to be the passenger in the chariot. Shariram ratamevatu. Simple Sanskrit. Body is the chariot. Buddhim tu saratim viddhi. Know the intellect which is thinking right now, which is trying to understand this right now. Remember, that's the driver. It's not you. It's not you. It's the driver. Manah pragraha evacha. So what's the wheel which the driver is holding? It's the mind. Mind is the reins which connects it to the horses. What are the horses? Indriyani hayanahu. Haya, horse. The sense organs are called the horses. Vishayan steshu gocharan. The sense objects are the paths they run along. Atmendriya mano yuktam bhuktetyahur manishina. How do you become an experiencer? You, the self, who you really are. Remember, Nachiketa has asked, who am I really? What's the truth here? What's going on here? You, what you really are, with the mind and the intellect, in the body using the senses, you are called bhokta. Bhokta means the experiencer. It's often translated as enjoyer, but need not be enjoyment only. It can be suffering, mostly suffering. Bhokta means the one who enjoys and suffers. Suffers, enjoys and suffers what? This world. When? All the time. It's what you call life. The life which we are leading now is you having forgotten what you really are, identified with the... It's like a person who's sitting in the car and has forgotten that he's the passenger. He thinks, I am the whole car. The car and the wheels and the intellect, the driver and the steering wheel, all of that I am. And now driving along the pathways of life. He's forgotten his own separate existence. That's what you are. Now, Yama will use this to describe the fundamentals of spiritual life. What he will say, I'm not going through the verses, what he will say basically is this. These three are important. The horses in a chariot, the mind which holds the horses in check, and the driver, the charioteer. These three are important. Pay attention to them. Your intellect, the driver, the wheel which is used to control the car, and the car itself, the wheels, the sense organs, the horses. Which the horses have to be good, the mind has to be good, and the intellect has to be good. He says what it means to be good and how do you train them and how do you perfect them, we will see. If those are in shape, then you will reach your goal in life. If those are out of order, all your efforts will be sabotaged. Your efforts in spiritual life, even your efforts in secular life, everything will be sabotaged if those three are not in order. You see, let's take them from outside inwards. The sense organs first. What we see, what we taste, what we hear. There's this professor of psychology here in America, Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, Haidt, I think. He's written this book, The Happiness Hypothesis. It sounds like one of those new self-help books, but it's a pretty serious work actually. He takes up this very interesting question. We all want to change. We all want to be good. We all want our lives to be better. But why is it that after reading so many books, listening to so many lectures, doing so many practices, we really don't seem to change much? If you go out to the bookshops now, one of the richest and well-stocked sections will be the self-help section. So many books which promise that you can revolutionize your life. You can have friends, you can communicate better, you can manage your time, you can lose weight, you can... you can meditate, you can be absolutely fit. All those things are promised. And all of it in 7 days. They promise you all of that, and it's easy, and it can be done fast. If that's so true, why isn't it working? That's the question he asks. And the answer he gets to is very interesting. He says, we are not an integrated personality. We have an intellect. You can map it to what Yama says thousands of years ago before Jonathan Haidt. He says we have an intellect, but we also have sense organs. And he says a good model, look at the model he gives. A good model is like a man riding on an elephant. The elephant rider, he gives that model. You see, the elephant rider, the mahout, the person who controls the elephant, he understands where he wants to go. He can read a map. The elephant cannot read the map. And the elephant is not interested in your map. Now, if the elephant listens to the instructions given by the mahout will reach the destination. If the elephant does not listen, if the elephant is not in a listening mood, the elephant is much stronger than the mahout. The mahout cannot drag the elephant where he wants to go. The elephant is going to win every time. If the elephant wants to go there and eat bananas from a shop, it will do that. You can't stop it. It's an elephant after all. Exactly like that. The intellect is convinced by books. The intellect is convinced by talks. The moment you read a very nice book, get up early in the morning and do yoga, your life will be much better. You're convinced. And it's true. It's not false. It's true. If you were able to get up in early in the morning and do yoga every day, within a few weeks, months, years, your life would be measurably better. It's true. It's not false. But why can't we do it? The reason is, the intellect doesn't have to do the yoga. The yoga is supposed to be done by the body. And the body has its own intelligence. It's like the elephant. The body has a certain height, points it out. Our body has an autonomous intelligence. Actually, neuroscience is beginning to show even the gut has its own intelligence. Everywhere in the body where there are clusters of nerves, nerve centers, there is an autonomous intelligence functioning there. Quite apart from the intellect. And that is like the elephant. It does not respond to books. There is an intelligence in the tongue, in the sense organs. It does not respond to the diet chart. It has got its own agenda. Diet chart has convinced your intellect, but it has not convinced your tongue, because your tongue doesn't read those diet charts. It's interested in the experience it gets when it eats that, you know, chocolate fudge or something. That's what it's interested in. Yes, and it has a power of its own. Like the elephant, it controls action. What it will do, the tongue. It's my business what I eat. After all, I'm going to do the eating. The fancy intellect is not going to do the eating. So I'll eat what I like. You tell the intellect, you read what you like. But what I'll eat is my business. After all, I'm the one doing the eating. One person was saying that I have seen few taste buds, a cluster of primitive cells on my tongue, not even the whole tongue, just a part of the tongue, dragging a mountain of a man into a pie shop. This huge, strong guy, maybe a biker. I saw that, this huge bike parked outside a bar, and this big guy with a beard and huge guy, you know, he's going in there to stuff himself with food and drink. Who's pulling him along? There's a tiny bit of cells pulling him along. I saw myself we had gone to visit an old gentleman in a rehabilitation center, assisted living center. And outside in the smoking area, there was this man sitting on a wheelchair, sick. And he's there to smoke a cigarette. Now I'm thinking, look at this. Look at this power of that, the taste, the experience of having a smoke. It says to the body and mind, I know you are sick. I know you can hardly raise your hand. But you have to smoke. It's my demand. I remember I saw a movie long time ago. It was about a ghost. As a kid at that time. It was a Hollywood movie. I never thought I'd come and live in Hollywood one day. Now the story was, the person is dead and he used to smoke a lot. And the way they have shown it is, he is like a faint mist now, like a ghost or something misty. And he's standing in front of a cigarette vending machine in a train station and trying to grab a packet of cigarettes. But he cannot grab anything physical in this world because he doesn't have a body. And he's desperately trying to grab that. By seeing that, even as a kid I used to read a little bit of Vedanta. But what struck me was, no wonder that Vedanta says it's our desires which force us into newer and newer births. What that person, that ghost needs at that moment is a body more than anything else. He wants a body. You think, who would want to be born in this world? I've suffered enough. We do. We demand to be born in this world. We think we right now, you said, I know I wouldn't want to be born in this world. Just you wait. When the body is not there, the first thing we'll want again, the order, to God, a new body. What can poor God do? Gives us a new body. Okay, go out and play. So, the senses have their own agenda. And Jonathan Haidt points it out. Intellect understands. Intellect has its plans, its diet charts, its daily schedule and to-do lists. The body has its own thing. I want to wake up early in the morning. Intellect agrees, it would be a good thing. But early in the morning, it's the body which has to come out of the blankets into the, you know, out of the comforter into the freezing cold. I don't have to tell you about freezing cold here in Cedar Rapids. So the body refuses. Tells the intellect, you keep your fancy ideas. I'm not getting out into that cold now. I want to sleep a little more. So what Jonathan Haidt says, what does the elephant respond to? The important question is, what does the elephant respond to? The elephant responds to training. The elephant responds to habit. In training, what do you train an elephant to do, or any other animal to do? Training is not reading. When you train a dog or an elephant or whatever, any animal, or the shamu, the whale, or whatever, they are trained through reward and punishment and through different protocols to respond to ingrain new habits in them, not new ideas. So the senses have to be trained. Yama just says, Yama, in this he says, if your horses are good, then you will reach your goal. The passenger will reach his goal. And if the horses are not good, you'll be derailed. You'll go off track. In the same way, the senses have to be trained. They do not respond to arguments. They do not respond to books. They do not respond to good intentions. They do not respond to Vedanta lectures. It's the intellect which responds. But the senses respond to training. So senses have to be trained. Getting up early in the morning, you have to make a habit out of it. Practicing yoga every day, you have to make a habit out of it. Eating healthy, you have to make a habit out of it. Daily habit of study, you know, just of studying the scriptures or Vedanta, Upanishads. Make a habit out of it. You see, in the lives of all great spiritual practitioners, they all had strong, good habits. How to replace bad habits with good habits is a science in itself. I'll just recommend the latest book, very nice book has been written recently, The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg, D-U-H-I-G-G, Power of Habit, using modern psychology, positive psychology, very scientific method, very nice way they have approached it. How do you break out of bad habits? How do you generate and set up good habits? But the point here is, at the sensory level, it has its own intelligence. Remember, it's the elephant. The body and the senses, they have to be trained. Once it is trained, it's very interesting. Just as bad habits are difficult to overcome, good habits are also difficult to break. You may be amazed at this person who gets up so early in the morning, spends hours in meditation. You ask that person, he says, I cannot help it. I'd be quite unhappy if I did not do it. It's become a habit over years. A Swami who was in the ICU, about to die in a few days' time. Old Swami, we heard the story. Now in the ICU, in the hospital, you cannot make out whether it's day or night. It's all these lights are on and the nurses are busy moving around. And you're surrounded by sick people, dying people. And the doctors said, the nurses said, they're on duty, that the Swami would get up exactly at 3:40 in the morning. I don't know how, you didn't have a clock. He would get up, he would struggle up in the bed like this and start repeating the mantra. Habit. A lifelong habit. 40, 50 years of doing that, it's become a habit. He is not putting forward an enormous amount of willpower. I have to get up and meditate even though I'm dying. I have to do that. No. It's become automatic now. So the senses, at the level of senses, very important. Desires operate at the level of senses, at the level of the mind, at the level of the intellect. So at the level of senses, we have to train them. And in training, at least one thing I'll mention, a good routine is necessary. Stick to the good routine. Sitting in for meditation early in the morning and evening, repeating the mantra, what the Guru has given, whatever spiritual practice we have been initiated into. We all know that Guru has told us to make a habit out of it. So a habit of sitting down at the same time. You will find the mind calms down at the same time. It gets ready for meditation. It's a creature of habit. Body is a creature of habit. The senses are a creature of habit. Now we come one step deeper. The mind itself. Mana. Manas. It's like the wheel in the hand of the driver. It's what controls the senses. Your wheels of the car are perfect. They are all in running order. Sensors are well trained. But what happened? Why is the car going this way and that way? You know, the driver sits down to drive the car and the wheel comes up in his hand. How are you going to drive? The wheel is not connected properly. Mind. At the level of mind, what does Yama recommend? He recommends that senses are to be trained. The horses are to be trained. The mind, he says, samanaska. He says samanaska. The Sanskrit word samanaska is literally translated into a word which is familiar to most people today, especially those who are interested in Buddhism. Samanaska literally translates into mindfulness. Into mindfulness. You see, we live our lives in a fog of unawareness. Most of the time we are operating on default. What are you doing? How are you sitting? Are you aware of it? What are you thinking now? Are you aware of it? What are you talking? Are you aware of it? No. We are not conscious. We are always slipping off. You know, when we see in those old slapstick comedy movies, somebody slips on a banana and falls down, we laugh. It's cruel, but we laugh. Well, we are always slipping on the banana peel. We are slipping off into the past or into the future. All the time. All the time we are operating in the mode of what if only. What if this happens or what if that happens. And if only I had said this, if only I had done that, if only I had taken this job instead of that job, if only I had married this person instead of that person, if only I had gone to this place instead of that place, and so on. If only, regrets about the past. Thinking about the past. It's gone. It's gone. And thinking about the future. Anxieties, hopes, expectations about the future. You're continuously slipping off. Never here and now. Mindfulness is being here and now. Samanaska. Awareness. One thing that the desires, our samskaras hate, is light being thrown upon them. Our samskaras, the inherent tendencies, you know how they are formed. At first it comes up as a thought, or it comes up as something we see or something we taste. Not so important. Then next stage the mind begins to dwell on it. That person behaved, suppose somebody behaves badly with you. At first you are surprised. Nothing much. But then the mind begins to dwell on it. On the injustice of it. I didn't do anything to that person. Why did that person why was he rude to me? People are always taking advantage of me. I am being rude. I should be more assertive. The mind starts dwelling upon it. Resentment builds up. And the next time you see somebody acting that way, irritation comes then. A flash of irritation. And then anger. And it becomes a pattern. It becomes a pattern. Greed. Nothing starts with greed. Even the most tastiest food or the thing which we like, we get a little bit of it. There's a feeling it's nice. That's the beginning. And then mind dwells on it. It would be nice to have some more. Okay. And then you go out and act. Stock it up in the refrigerator. And then you start snacking on it. Morning, afternoon, evening. And it becomes a samskara. A tendency. When the time it becomes a tendency, it's already run a groove into your mind. And we tend to start repeating that. All of this happens. That first bud of it's nice. What? It may be nice, but not very worthwhile. But we forget it's not worthwhile. It's nice. I want to taste that again. I want to see that again. I want to hear that again. I want to touch that again. I want to be in that place. I want to be with that person. I want to do that work and not this work. It starts there, that liking. Then we think about it. The groove becomes deeper. Then we start doing it. Groove becomes even deeper. And in certain cases, like addictions, it's no longer a groove. It's the Grand Canyon. It's been dug deep into our minds. It's extremely difficult to change at that level. Extremely difficult. Samskaras changing, samskaras is difficult. Samskaras are deep pathways. Nowadays they are saying that actually it's there physically. Earlier they used to say that all the neural connections in the brain are set by the time you're 6 or 7 years old, and that's it. Now they are saying that this neuroplasticity and all, that yes, strong connections are made in childhood, But all the time the brain is dynamic. It keeps changing. They're saying a person who becomes, in a gross sense, becomes addicted to a drug, the neurology of the person changes, it seems. They were saying that certain receptors die out, other receptors become larger in number. So the body, the nervous system now is designed to demand that drug, physically designed to do that. So the craving they're feeling is a physical craving. That samskara has become a Grand Canyon. So what this process hates is awareness. Awareness, all you have to do is to see what's happening. Samanaska, mindfulness. At the level of, and how you are mindful, and this famous Buddhist teacher is there, Thich Nhat Hanh. If you have not read that book, you should read that book, Miracle of Mindfulness. Miracle of Mindfulness. It's based on Vipassana meditation. Thich Nhat Hanh, he's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. He often comes to USA to give lectures. But his best-selling book is The Miracle of Mindfulness. It's as simple as this. Right now, if you try it, it's connected with the breath. You breathe, it goes like this. I'll show you once and you can try it. It goes like this. One simple practice. Breathing in. I am here. Here. Breathing out. Now. Breathing in, here, nowhere else. Breathing out, now. Breathing in, I am happy. Breathing out, I smile. Repeat this cycle. Breathing in, here. Breathing out, now, just now. Not even 1 minute ago, not even 1 minute later. Breathing in, I am happy. Breathing out, I smile. That practice. There are many variations of this practice. But basically, it anchors us to the present here and now. Otherwise, we are always slipping off. Amanaska. In fact, in Hindi, Bengali, the words are amanaska. Onnamanasko. Samanasko means being with the mind. Let the mind be there right now. Be aware of it. Samanasko. Miracle of mindfulness. One Zen teacher was asked, what is your miracle? He says, my miracle is when I cut the wood, I cut wood. When I draw water from the well, I draw water from the well. That is my miracle. So our miracle should be, when I do the dishes, I do the dishes. Or you can combine it. I do the dishes and repeat the mantra. But basically you are aware. Swami Vivekananda puts it in a powerful little mantra, you can say, in English. He says, goodness will come, power will come, glory will come, all that is great and excellent will come when the sleeping soul is roused to self-conscious action. Self-conscious activity. What is this self-conscious? Not in a bad sense, I'm self-conscious of myself. No, awareness. What's going on in the mind? What's going on within? In the senses, in the mind, in the intellect. That is called samanaska. When? All the time. The moment you feel I'm not aware, come back to awareness. Gently, without regrets. Oh, hours have passed before I look back into myself. Doesn't matter. Look into yourself now gently. Don't bewail it. That's also a trick of the mind. I'm no good at this. Then you go off on another trip, a guilt trip. No. Just come back to awareness. Samanaska. This process of unconscious living or semi-conscious living cannot bear the light of awareness. It short-circuits this process. That's why awareness is extremely important. Buddha, when he got Nirvana, when he was walking towards Sarnath, before he gave the first sermon, the story goes, this shepherd boy, coward boy, saw him and so amazed to see the look on his face and asked him, not who are you, this Houston Smith in his book on world religions, Buddhism, chapter 1, writes this. Many people have been asked, who are you? Very few in history have been asked, what are you? This little boy asks Buddha, what are you? Are you a god? Buddha says no. Are you an angel? Buddha says no. Are you a man? Buddha says no. Then what are you? He says, I am the awakened. I am Buddha. Buddha literally means the awakened. Meaning thereby the rest of us are not fully awake. We are not in sleep either, though Vedanta tends to have that effect on people, putting them to sleep. But we are semi-awake. Sleep at least, no problem. You are not up to any mischief if you are sleeping. But semi-awake, a lot of mischief is going on. So, samanaska. And the third one, final one today, is you go deeper. The driver himself. Remember, the vehicle, the sensory system, that's one. Training is important. The mind, the wheel, samanaska, mindfulness. Training, he says sadashwa, the good horses. Good horses are trained horses. Training or habit, good habits are necessary. At the level of the mind, mindfulness. Now at the level of the intellect is what decides. Most of the time, we do not decide. It works by default. Whatever the senses present to us, whatever the mind does with that, processes it, the intellect says yes. Intellect does not exercise its filtering power. In default, it just goes by default. You know, in computers, when you boot it up, I don't know if it's there these days, is a default setting. So whatever is programmed into it, that will happen if you switch on the computer. But you have an option of changing it. You have to catch it at that moment. In earlier computers, you have to, they'll give you 5 seconds or something like that to go in there. It's exactly like that. The intellect has a tiny window of opportunity before the senses and the mind translate it into action, into words, into thought, into words and action. Thinking, words and action. They start. Before that, the intellect has a tiny window of opportunity to say yes or no. To select, to permit or not to permit. Normally we don't use it. We don't use it. It just happens by automatically. The intellect listens to the whisperings of the senses. This is nice. And the intellect sort of gives in. Though the intellect may know better. So this, in our monastery in India, this is Swami who had, he was telling me, see how the intellect functions. He had diabetes and the doctor told him he should not take sweets. Now Rasgulla comes. Rasgulla is a Bengali sweet. It's very sweet. So it comes and there's a person coming with a bucket full of that and giving to everybody. And Swami, the tongue says, I want. And the intellect says, no. Doctor clearly has said, no, you should not take it. And sort of an intellect is half awake. The intellect sort of gives in to the demands of the tongue and says, all right, give me half of And sometimes there would be, there's this funny idea that it's full of syrup, the rasgulla. So this funny idea that if you squeeze out the syrup and take only the cheese ball, it won't be so harmful. Doctors say that's not true. Anyhow, many people have had that there. So a very funny thing happened. All the monks were sitting and this old monk who was not supposed to eat sweets. So every time anybody would come with the rasgulla, he would say, squeeze it out. And give me the sweet. Remove the syrup from it. He would say, squeeze it. Now, this young novice who had come, who did not know Bengali, and he was serving it, he just understood what he meant by that. And he said, squeeze it and give it. So he came to this old Swami and he heard, squeeze it. So he squeezed the syrup on his plate and took away the sweet. and the Swami goes, and everybody all around, all the other monks, they burst into laughter just like this. They saw what had happened. Intellect does not use its power of decision. Yama tells Nachiketa a very beautiful verse, the mantra, which I will repeat. You come to 121. 1, 2, 1. I'll repeat that. Anyat shreyo anyaduteva preya te ubhe nanarthe purusham sinita tayo shreya adadanasya sadhu bhavati hiyate arthad yau preyo vrinite. Yama says to Nachiketa that all the time before you, two things are coming. The good and the pleasant. Shreya and Preya. Preya means pleasant, nice. Shreya means what is good. The good and the pleasant are coming all the time before you. The one who selects, whose intellect selects the pleasant over the good, never attains his goal in life, whatever may be the goal in life. And the one who selects consistently the good over the pleasant will attain the goal of life. What does it mean? Once you have a goal, it may be making $1 million, it may be realizing God. Then what will happen is everything in life becomes clear once your goal is selected. Once the goal is selected, what will take me towards the goal and what will not take me towards the goal becomes clear. We should be able to attain it. What is the problem? The problem is there are a lot of things which the elephant likes. The elephant likes bananas. Bananas may not be good for your, it may not be relevant to your goal in life. The mahout who is going there, but the elephant wants that. Now you are on the elephant. You are in this body and mind. You have selected a goal means who has selected the goal? Your intellect has selected the goal. I want to realize God. Or I want to be healthy and lose 50 pounds. Or I want to give up smoking. I have selected the goal, intellect. But the body, the sense organs, they have their own priorities. So for them, certain things are nice, pleasant, which may be quite contrary to your goal. The energies of the body and mind, they flow automatically towards what's pleasant for the body and mind. It may not be what's good for you. So there's often a contradiction. You see, the pleasant and the good are like two salespeople who come before you. They're rarely selling the same thing. They're often selling two different things. So it's contradictory. Now, unfortunately, the prayers, the pleasant, the ones, the salesperson is a much better salesperson. Partly because we are willing to listen to him. He's got all this, he's got a nice laptop and a projector and he has got this nice products and he gives you lots of things. And he says, see, both of them have the same goal. Both of them ultimately are selling the same product, happiness. The pleasant and the good. Both of them ultimately are selling the same thing. You will be happy if you listen to me. That's what both of them are saying. The thing is, the one who is selling the pleasant, that salesman, he says, you'll be happy right now. You'll be happy straight away. But what he does not say is, this happiness will destroy you. He said, happiness will go away very soon. Life will be gone very soon. Nothing will be pleasant in life. I won't be, my health will break down. I won't be able to eat this. I won't be able to go there. I won't be able to watch that movie. Nothing will work very soon. And then the pleasant salesman will disappear from our lives. He won't come anymore. And the salesman of the good just shrugged his or her shoulders. You didn't listen to me. The salesman who's selling the good, what is according to our goal in life, is not a particularly good salesman. Not that any fault of that salesman, but it's because we don't listen. We are not interested. What they are selling is, what the good salesman is selling is, what will give us happiness, truly lasting happiness, but it will take a little bit of time. It takes a little bit of effort. And it's true for anything in life. You want to be a good student and get into Harvard or something like that? That also requires that immediately life becomes divided into what's pleasant and what's good. The pleasant has a power of pulling us off track. So he says, if you follow the pleasant, you'll be pulled off the path to your goal and you'll be swept away. You will not attain your goal. And ultimately, the unfortunate thing is, the pleasant is ephemeral. It will come and go. And then we are left high and dry. Time has gone. Body has aged. Our resources have been spent. And then we are left with nothing. It's a chimera. It's something like a mirage which deludes us. If it did give us some kind of permanent happiness, I would still say that, okay, we got something out of it. But it does not. So, preya, one who takes up the prayer. Hiyate artha dhyau preyo vraniti. The one who selects the pleasant and gives up the good, even after deciding that that's my goal and this will take me to my goal, I don't take that. I take this one. Then I will fall away from that goal, he says. That means I will not attain my goal in spiritual life. And selecting the pleasant, you may have a nice time for a short while, but it ends pretty fast. Now, I will just conclude here, sum up the takeaway from this talk. This is the foundation of spiritual life. Sensory level, at the level of the mind, at the level of the intellect. Senses, mind, intellect. Remember, the takeaway from this talk is the chariot model. Chariot or car, whichever is easier to remember. Remember the chariot? You are the passenger in the chariot. The chariot is the body. The horses are the sense organs. The paths they run upon are the sense objects. You decide what they have to run upon. The mind is the one by which you control the sense, the horses and the chariot. It's the reins, it's the wheel of the car. The intellect is your driver. Now, Yama says, all three have to be taken care of. Otherwise, no spiritual life can. No success in secular life also is possible. You can see in your own lives, you are all successful people. You have been successful to the extent that you have controlled these three. Managed these three. Self-management. To the extent that we have not been able to do it, we have not reached the heights we would have liked to reach. So, the senses have to be, Yama says, Sad Ashwa, good horses. Good horses translates into training. Training translates into habit. So at the level of senses, the takeaway is habits. An effort, consistent effort to create good habits and overcome bad habits. Here the solution is only training. Not reading, not thinking, not even wishing for it. Actual hard work to generate good habits. At the level of the senses, go deeper, the mind. At that level, mindfulness. Be here, be now, watch yourself. Watch what? What is happening at the level of the senses, what is happening at the level of the mind, and what is happening at the level of the intellect. Watch it. Throw the light of awareness. What are my senses doing? What am I thinking? What am I saying? What am I doing? At the level of the mind, speech and action. Samanaska. So the key word here is mindfulness. And at the level of the intellect, decision. Intellect can take decisions. It's a great power in my life. We make a mistake of taking a decision once. At the beginning, on 31st December, make a to-do list for my New Year's. But it mostly remains unimplemented because we do not exercise the power of decision consistently and over time. When do you have the power of decision? All the time. At this moment also. You have right now the power of deciding what you will do with your body now, what you will say now, what you will think now. We make a mistake by thinking that I take decisions but it's difficult to hold on to my decisions. You see what the trick is? Holding on to the decision is a long-term thing. 1 hour, 1 day, 1 month, 1 year. That's difficult. But what's completely easy and easily doable is holding on to it for 10 seconds or for 1 minute only. Everyone can do that. And after that, what do? You take another decision. The next minute, I will hold on to it. Why take one decision? Continuously exercise the intellect. That's what Yamaraja is saying. All the time, the pleasant and the good keep coming to you. All the time you have to decide. Not default. Not automatic. Automatic, then it will go the way of the senses. What the senses whisper into the intellect, intellect will do that. With awareness, take decisions. Continuously take decisions. If you fail 1,000 times, no problem. Because right now is a chance for a fresh decision. As you keep doing that, it will get easier. Very soon, the more you do it, take decisions throughout the day, more you do it, and just not think about the past. We sabotage ourselves by thinking about past failures. Don't think about it. It's gone. Really, really gone. More we take decisions, the easier it becomes. This prepares us for spiritual life. He says the passenger in the chariot will reach destination. Destination is enlightenment, freedom, moksha. When? So the one to repeat again. Three things we take away from this. Habit, mindfulness, decision. Senses, mind, intellect.
Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ram Krishna Arpanamastu.
So we still have time for maybe a couple, two or three questions. It's 12:20. 12:30 you have to wrap up, right? So, in the evening class, we will take up next part of Yama's teaching, the path of vichara, to realize who am I. What is the technique? He will teach us a technique. It's subtle. So I can already see people are going in their minds, ah, so the real thing is being saved up for the evening. It's true, that's a deeper thing, but I would always say that the real thing is this. I would urge all of you and all of us, including myself, to think more about this than anything else. Highest Vedanta awaits you. There's no problem there. The real problem is here. Without this foundation, everything that we build upon it will one day collapse. With this foundation, the rest of it is not so difficult. It happens quite easily. It follows as a matter of course. Questions?
Yeah. You mentioned in the beginning, I have been thinking for some time why it is like that. Because you mentioned our Lord Krishna plagiarizing the Upanishad. And right here in the Upanishad, the two Upanishads, I find the same sloka verbatimly repeated.
Yes.
Though they originated from different Vedas.
Yes.
I mean, my question is, how did they communicate and all that?
Yes, so there was this body of spiritual knowledge, the rishis who developed these ideas, who got this realization and then expressed it in these forms. That's what became the Upanishads. The rishis were the enlightened persons who were the teachers of mankind. So they gave this knowledge to us. And it's more or less common to all the Vedas. So sometimes you'll find the original verses being repeated in different Upanishads and in the Gita later on. And later on you will find Shankaracharya quoting that. And the other great masters of non-duality like Vidyaranya, Madhusudan Saraswati, in different forms, Sureshwaracharya, quoting the same thing. So communicate, I don't know if they had seminars and workshops and things like that. But they definitely had a very vibrant spiritual culture at that time. People used to go and learn from each other. We find in the Upanishads themselves how sages and kings are going all the time going to each other and they would communicate, they would speak to each other. It's not that they were always sitting quietly and then they got an idea and they gave out a verse. They talked, they debated, they quarreled, and they came to certain conclusions. That was the common heritage of Vedanta. That's why it's repeated. And it's common to all of us. Often you find the persons who gave this, the names are not found. But it's a common heritage to all of humanity, not just for Hindus or anything like that. It's an impersonal teaching. You see, there is no question of a God to believe in, separate, you know, idea of this person, this particular name, this revelation. No. What you are talking about here is your own reality. After all, what is he talking about? He's talking about your body. He's talking about your own sense organs. He's talking about your mind. He's talking about your intellect. And talking about the reality, behind this intellect. The passenger in the chariot of your own body. There is no question of believing in something out there. He says, look at what exists right now and investigate it. A philosophical investigation, a spiritual investigation. Questions?
I have a question, Maharaj.
Yes.
Maharaj, it's easy to acknowledge and perceive, identify senses, and there is always some constant noise in the head. Is that noise of the charioteer, or is it the mind?
The continuous noise in the head, the voice in the head, just sort of chattering, and often it's meaningless chattering, this and that all the time. That's the intellect. Intellect and the mind also. Thoughts, emotions, feelings at the level of the mind. Continuous input is there at the level of the senses. And the intellect has these ideas. concepts, ideas, decisions. So all the time the three are active. Senses are active, mind is active, intellect is active. The mixture is what you call this, the background noise of our life. It's much better to engage it. That's why the Guru says, you can repeat the mantra whenever you want. That's a very good practice. It's a powerful thing which affects the intellect first, and then the mind, and even ultimately the senses and the whole body. Yes.
Maharaj, mind, we know mind can go wrong. Can intellect also go wrong?
Oh yes. Oh yes, all the time. Go wrong in the sense it takes the wrong decision, mostly because of lack of awareness. We are not aware of what's going on. Intellect takes an automatic decision. A habit, default decision. I want that sweet. I know the intellect knows that I have diabetes, and the doc has told me not to eat sweets. That information is there. The senses demand it. The mind runs after the senses. Senses are not in the control of the mind. And the intellect is supposed to act as a decision maker. And so what the intellect says is, just this once won't matter. So all of it falls in line with the senses. And we are pulled into the sweet shop or something. Yeah. Yes.
When you make a decision, the children are small. They can make their own decision to get their goal. Can they? Adult can make their own decision. But sometimes they take the group decision.
Yes. Now the thing is, often adults also cannot make their own decisions. Not because we cannot, we do not. That's the sad part of it. We don't use that power of decision. And children often are even more unable to use the power of decision. So that's why in childhood habits are good. So if the good habits are inculcated, they'll keep on doing the right thing. Good habits, good training is very important. But the training to make decisions also is important. The child should be allowed to make decisions again and again. Maybe it will fail. It's your decision. But the consequences should also be pointed out. Often the child makes a wrong decision and the parent shields the child from the consequences. That also should not be there. And the power of decision should become clear. I make the right decision in the long run, not in the short run. In the long run, I am happy. I see that for myself. The child should be given experience to see that for himself or herself. One thing which helps the intellect to make good decisions is calmness of the mind and the senses. Because the intellect has a very small window to make a decision before the mind and the senses start acting. So, if you can be a calm person, maybe even a little slow-moving person, then the decisions are better than a fast-reacting person. That's why meditation, they have now, through some actual experiments, they have proved that meditation helps us in our decision-making process. Certain parts of the, I think, left brain and something, it becomes a prefrontal cortex, they are saying that it becomes more active when a person is more meditative. Because it gives it a chance to act. It seems that our primitive and animal brain, it reacts fast. And the more modern, they call it the neocortex or something. So that takes time to react. Intellect works through that. That's why you should give the intellect time to act. It's better not to, if you're doing something good, do it. Doing something that's a little dicey, wait. Give it time. Maybe the intellect will take a better decision. So meditation is very helpful for the intellect. Intellect becomes stronger, more able to take a decision and implement it if you are meditative. Patience is a great virtue. Patience is not suppression. I'm angry, but okay, I have to be patient. I will not say a harsh word. That person is boiling inside already. That's not patience. Patience says, all right, this person behaved rudely. I'm not affected by it. Doesn't matter. Just a few words anyway. If you react fast, then you are at the mercy of the world. I read about Dr. Hunt, Julian Hunt or John Hunt or something, a surgeon in England, who was very rigid, and he would react very fast to criticism. And he said, it's a tragedy that my blood pressure is at the mercy of the whole world. Anybody contradicts me? And you know, the horror of it was, in a medical conference, somebody stood up and criticized what he had said. And he was so furious, he stalked out of the room, fell into the hands of a fellow physician, and died of a heart attack. Swami Vivekananda says, you are slaves. Slave to a good word, slave to a bad word. Just a little bit of praise and so happy. What does it matter if somebody praises or not? I know what I am. Doesn't make me one bit better or one bit worse. Somebody criticizes, I am completely. In positive psychology, they call it catastrophizing. Everything is ruined in my life. It's horrible. He has said, or she has said, something critical about me. Really, I'm awful. No, it's not true. So, the intellect, it's helped if you are a patient person. Holy Mother used to say that Shodjer Shoman Gunne, there is no virtue equal to patience. And Sri Ramakrishna played on this word, a pun. Je shoy, she roy. Je na shoy, tar na shoy. In Bengali, what it means is the one who forbears, who is patient, he will live, he will exist, he will continue, he will prosper. The one who does not forbear, who reacts, will be destroyed. Okay, we've run out of time. Thank you very much.